Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly analysis of major economic events, trends, developments in our environment, national, international, all the things that shape our jobs, our incomes, our debts, and what we hope for our kids in the way of an economic future. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I currently teach as a visiting professor at the New School University in New York City. I also write regular columns for Truthout. Truthout.org is a remarkable, independent, courageous source of news and analysis every day. Check them out at truthout.org. If the kinds of programs that we present to you each week are of interest, we urge you, please, to visit and make use of our websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites contain all kinds of materials that amplify and supplement what we do on these programs. And both of those emails provide you with other opportunities. For example, you can send us your comments, criticisms, and questions. We read every one and use them to plan this program. Another thing you can do on the websites is sign up for our free newsletter that brings you materials beyond what we do on the radio, brings you up to date on the various activities we're engaged in. It's a way of having this sort of thing brought to you personally through the email system. So do please consider signing up for our newsletter. It's no charge whatsoever. It comes to you several times a year. If, in addition, you would be interested, please let us know of ways that we can make this program more useful to you. That would be a service you can provide us to enable us to provide a better service for you. And finally, please follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Turning to our updates for this week, before I introduce you to today's program guest. First, I wanted to bring to your attention a decision made the last week by the European Food Safety Authority. This struck me, and there was a story in the New York Times on December 18th about it. It has to do with a pesticide that has been linked in many continents now to the remarkable and dangerous death of huge numbers of bees around the world, particularly in Europe and North America. Bees, as you know, are not just producers of honey, important as though that is, but are also crucial to pollinating many, many other crops that we depend on for our food supply. So the Europeans are very upset and have begun the process of removing permission for these pesticides to be used. The Environmental Protection Agency here in the United States says there's not enough evidence. The Europeans don't feel that way. Even the National Academy of Sciences here in the United States says there needs to be more research because the evidence is already sufficient to warrant that. I want to tell you two things. First, where this pesticide shows up, and then what's at issue here. The pesticide shows up in lots of the regular sorts of powders and sprays that people around the world use for their vegetable and flower gardens. Bayer, the huge German pharmaceutical, produces Bayer Advanced Fruit, Citrus, and Vegetable Insect Control. That's available widely. It's sold, for example, at Home Depot stores across the United States. It contains this contested pesticide. And the other is the Ortho brand flower, fruit, and vegetable insect killer. If you use either of those, you should be concerned, since one of the effects is not only to kill the bees, but also it is now suspected has very bad health effects for children. What's at stake here, really briefly? What's at stake here is conflicting motives. The motive of the drug companies, Bayer and so on, that are heavily involved, and there are several of them, is obviously profit. This is a very profitable product. they want to continue using it. So they immediately issued statements that the evidence isn't sufficient and that there are other factors involved, the usual claim by a profit-making capitalist corporation to be allowed to continue to do what other people, in this case governmental and private scientific agencies, are disputing. On the government side, their motive is presumably to keep the population safe. But let's be unkind and assume that the government overreaches sometimes, bans things without the complete story. Then let me leave you with this question. Which do you want to happen? Do we want to err on the side of what's profitable for pharmaceuticals, or do we want to err on the side of what maybe overactive government oversight might be doing to us? In one case, we get sick and worse. In the other case, well, I leave it to your judgment to decide which way this one ought to be decided. The next economic update is I want to talk about a number of political events, all in the last week or so, that suggest a change in the way increasing numbers of people around the world are responding to the economic crisis that is now entering its seventh year. 2007 December is when it officially began, and we're now in December of 2013. So we finished the years we've had, six, and we're heading into seven. So let me give you a roundup of three different places in the world, three different countries, where things are happening that came to a head over the last week. First, Chile in Latin America. A candidate there, Michelle Bachelet, I hope that's how it's pronounced, won the election there with over 62% of the vote, virtually a landslide, a 2-1 margin over the pro-Pinochet candidate against whom she ran. She was a leader of Chile before and has had a few years working in the United Nations in their program for gender equality, came back out of the UN job and ran and won in Chile. It's very clear she's committed to massive reforms, and the substance of those massive reforms, and this is what I want to stress, is doing something about the unacceptable level of income and wealth inequality in Chile. That was the number one issue in the campaign. She took a strong position on moving away from the levels of inequality that they have now and towards levels of equalizing income and wealth, with some particular attention, I might note, to making education affordable in Chile, which was a struggle that the student organizations in that country mounted massive demonstrations over the last couple of years to fight for. I think that's an interesting movement of the voters in Chile, a country that has not been as badly hit by the crisis as many another in the world, but nonetheless has experienced the same growing inequality, and here is a reaction against it. The second example comes from the city of New York. Over the last week, we have had the last major speech of the outgoing mayor, Michael Bloomberg, and the first major economic speech of the incoming mayor, Bill de Blasio. And you couldn't have had a more stark demonstration of what I'm trying to get across. The contribution of Mayor Bloomberg, and there really is no polite way to describe this other than wondering what planet exactly he lives on, his comment was that the big problem facing New York, and I am not kidding, the big problem facing New York is the danger that politicians will work hand in glove with unions, labor unions, and thereby do harm to the future of New York. Now, of course, the reality for anyone who's not in the 1% with Michael Bloomberg, the reality is we have had 6 years of stunning demonstrations of the awful consequences for our entire world economy from the collusion between politicians and large banks and other major corporations. No one in their right mind would connect this crisis with the collusion between politicians and unions. Unions that in this country represent a small minority of all workers, public and private. But in the life and the mind of one part of the politicians of this country, like Michael Bloomberg, the big danger is politicians and unions. For almost everybody else, that's a bad joke. And to the credit of the incoming mayor de Blasio, like with Michelle Bachelet in Chile, he made it crystal clear that the problem is exactly the opposite, that we have a long history of the key collusion between politicians and those at the top of the economic ladder and not labor unions. And my third example comes from Italy. There is a remarkable movement there called in Italian I Forconi, and that is the roughly translation into English, the pitchforks, you know, like farmers carry. There are massive movements in the last week or two across most major Italian cities, Rome, Milan, Venice, Siena, and so on, of massive groups of people from across the political spectrum, the left and the right and the middle, denouncing the politicians of Italy for having imposed on Italy a horrific austerity program that magnifies the damage of the economic crisis that has hit Italy by putting on top of it an austerity program that preserves the privileges of the rich at the expense of even more suffering on the part of the mass of people. An extraordinary outpouring that led to the Interior Ministry of Italy, one Angelino Alfano, to make the following statement. Protest could heat up and lead to a spiral of rebellion against national and even European institutions. How interesting. What you reap, you can also sow. Or I think it goes the other way around. In any case, you get the idea. Next update has to do with colleges and universities here in the United States. I have given reports and updates in the past on the growing use made by universities of non-tenured professors, people who are teaching more and more courses across the universities for less and less money. They don't give your usual PhD graduate the kinds of jobs that used to be given, where you teach two or three courses a semester, you have the time and the support from the university to keep up with the research, to be as good a professor as you're capable of being and as your discipline permits you to be. These kinds of jobs are disappearing, and they're being replaced by a kind of job called adjunct. This is a person out of graduate school with a PhD, but who's not given a tenure-track job, who is not, in fact, hired as a regular faculty at all. They're given a specific job of teaching one or two or three specific courses. They're paid per course. And if they're not enough students, they don't get paid, the course doesn't fly. And they're paid much, much less than professors used to be. They do not qualify for tenure. That is, they cannot get job security. And the statistics are off the chart. We have literally replaced the majority of what used to be tenure track positions for professors with these young people, particularly, although they're now getting older too, who have five, six, seven jobs, teaching five, six, seven courses, often at three, four different universities in an area, running back and forth between them, no time to keep up with their profession, no time to barely do their teaching, underpaid, hassled, forever looking for jobs somewhere else from which they can live, and on and on. That story is bad enough, but I had to add the latest statistics provided by the Chronicle of Higher Education, the leading newspaper in the United States that covers college and university activities. And they had a lovely report this last week about the payment to the presidents of the 10 highest paid presidential positions in universities. And this is for the year 2011, the most recent year for which it's available. Coming in at number 10, Yale University paid its chief executive, Richard Levin, $1.7 million a year. I could list you all the others, and part of me would like to, but I'm going to jump to number one. Americans and the world are always interested in number one. Number one, Robert J. Zimmer, University of Chicago, who in 2011 took home $3.6 million. So if young people who are adjuncts are barely able to cobble together a life while doing more teaching than was ever demanded before, if they're wondering what the universities are doing with the money saved by underpaying their teachers, well, now you know. One wonderful use is to provide these sorts of salaries to the people at the top. Next update, a tale of two orchestras. First is the New York Philharmonic, perhaps the most famous orchestra in the United States, and the other one is the Minnesota Philharmonic, located in Minneapolis, St. Paul. What a story of difference. In both cases, the management of the orchestra is trying to pay less to the musicians. That's right. Even if you're a professional musician, even if you're at the top of your game, you don't escape from this economic crisis, and you're going to be whacked too. So the Philharmonic in New York, the musicians finally settled, and here's what the contract announced this last week gives them. 1%, I'm assuming that's 1% per year over the next 4 years, but you have to subtract from the 1% a year the fact that they are now going to have to pay a portion of their medical coverage before that was included in their salary. Well, 1% a year for the next 4 years means you're not even keeping pace with inflation. It means a musician is going to be able to buy fewer goods and services. But when you factor in that they're going to have to pay for their health care also a portion, then this is a key wage cut for the musicians. In Minnesota, they tried to do the same thing, but the musicians there reacted differently. They rejected the demands for wage cuts, and they've now reformed themselves as a collective workers' cooperative of musicians, and they are getting their concert series underway, and they're going to proceed, and they've responded to the demand to hurt them by this economic system by saying, we're going to change the rules of the game. We're not going to fold. We're not going to accept less. And if we do have some hard times, we're going to do it as a group making our own decisions, not being ripped off by the management and the others that typically dictate what happens. So I want to congratulate the musicians of the Minnesota Symphony for having the courage to form a workers' cooperative among their musicians, to launch their concert series, and to show that they're not going to knuckle under, and to give a different model from that offered by the Philharmonic of New York. Well, as usual, I have more updates, but we don't have the time. So I want to switch over, and I want to introduce you to my guest. So I want to begin by welcoming Professor Juan Flores to the program. So thank you very much for coming.
Thanks,
Rick. Let me tell you all who Juan Flores is. He's a professor in the Department of Social and Cultural Analysis at New York University in New York City. Affiliated with the Latino Studies program, his main scholarly interests include Puerto Rican and Latino and Latina culture, diaspora and transnational communities, social and cultural theory, and the Afro-Latino experience in the United States. He is the author of more books than we have the time to list for you here, and the winner of an equally impressive number of awards. He lectures widely, serves on a range of editorial and advisory boards, and is a founder of Afro-Latin Forum. So this is a person with a long, personal, and intense interaction with the Puerto Rican community, both on the island, in the United States, and generally. And so I wanted to invite him, and he was gracious enough to come, because I want to talk about how the American economy in general, but this crisis of the last 6 years in particular, has impacted the Puerto Rican community, both on the island and here, because in many ways it gives a stark and clear notion of what some of the social costs are of how this system works and how this crisis has done that or shaped that. So let me begin by the biggest difficult question. Give us an overview of how this crisis has impacted Puerto Rico, its economy, its politics, its culture.
Great. Okay. Well, first of all, everything that happens in Puerto Rico economically is conditioned by the United States. Puerto Rico is a direct colony of the United States, which means that its entire economic and political life are managed and manipulated from the center, from Washington and from Wall Street. So the whole economy of the society is floating is a floating kind of outcome of whatever happens here, and usually much, much worse. So as bad as things get here, they're always much worse in the colonies, and among oppressed or poor people in general. But in colonies, you could really see how it works, the direct effect of this. In fact, there's a statement, there's a little saying that we say that if the Americans get a cold, we get pneumonia. You know, so it's much more severe down there. And in fact, the crisis, there's always a state of crisis there. So it's almost like there's no non-crisis in a colonial economy. However, the present configuration of that didn't happen in 07, but in 06. It was actually preceded the crisis here. And in 2006, it got to a point where they actually had to have a government shutdown for most of the year. The government was shut down.
Why did this happen?
There were a range of reasons. One of the reasons was that in 2006, the tax loopholes and credits that were given to U.S. corporations for setting up shop in Puerto Rico that was introduced in 1976 expired. 30 years had elapsed, and all of a sudden, this way of the economy getting juiced up by the presence of U.S. corporations.
Who were there on a tax holiday.
Because if they do that, everything, they're exempt from all taxes. So, of course, they went down there in droves, right, in the 70s and in the 80s and so forth, and it was really a great boon for them. And then it began to get clear, well, this isn't going to last forever. This is a temporary fix, and that fix is going to end. So it was actually set up for a 20-year span, and in 1996, they decided to give it another 10 years. So then that second round elapsed. At that point, things really went, that was clear that something was up.
Would finally have to pay taxes.
They finally have to pay taxes. So that was a clear signal, you know, of the crisis. Now, another thing that happened at that point was also that the pension funds were getting to be too much to deal with. So they decided to just suspend the pension funds. So no more pensions. And then
the Puerto Rican government simply stopped paying pensions to retired
people?
Just
froze them. It froze the pension funds at that point. So people freaked out. Then they shut the government down, which put 150,000 public workers, and the economy is largely public labor. The public sector is a very huge part of the labor force in Puerto Rico. 150,000 of them were put out of work like that from one day to the next, where basically where their salaries were frozen. They had no income.
This happened in 2006.
And 1,500 public schools were closed, were shut down. So this was the crisis that happened at that point. And then a lot of it, you could see as it was transpiring, was about these kind of ongoing political infights between the two political parties that rule the country. Similarly to the way the Republican Democrats here kind of reach a point where things are paralyzed. Right. Nothing can happen because their main interest is outdoing the other and undermining anything that the other might do that might be seen as positive. Right. So all that is going on at a very high level amidst a level of corruption and scandals. The newspapers in Puerto Rico are filled from the front page through with the scandals of the politicians. They're just remarkable. It's like a mafia runs the country, right, in either party. And like the Democrats and Republicans, there's not a whole lot of difference in terms of what role they play in the society and what relationship that they have to the economic leaders of the society. So they're both in the pocket of that. Compound this then with the fact that the political status of the country is a colony. It's directly subordinate to the United States, right? That nothing really happens there that is not manipulated and controlled from above. There's no state. There's a government, but no state. If you go there, you use American dollars. Right. You know, they don't have any currency. They don't have citizenship. They're all American citizens, but not second, but third or fourth or fifth rank citizens. So that's the kind of situation that emerged in 2006, even before it hit here. Then when the crisis hit here, all of that got even worse. So things just kept on spiraling downward to this day. To right now, it's just worse than ever. And so the politicians run up to Washington to try to lobby for some kind of, you know, a grace or some kind of generosity or some kind of injection. And the Washington politicians are so busy dealing with stuff here that they tell them, sorry, you know, just use what we give you better. You know, we're not going to give you any more. Just use it better. and send them back. You know, so that's in a nutshell sort of what happened to the what happened to the economy. You know, what was the point where the recession officially set in, and which goes on until right now. As we speak.
Can you give us a rough idea of things like the unemployment rate and
the unemployment rate in Puerto Rico, the official unemployment rate, and that really has to be emphasized even more than it does here in Puerto Rico, is 15%. 15%.
So more than double what's here on the mainland.
More than double what's here, and that's a that's a serious underestimate of the people that are unemployed or partially employed or temporarily employed or no longer looking for work, as we know. Right. I mean, so that a lot, when you walk down the streets there's like loads of people hanging out in the street during weekdays because they don't have a job. You know, it's really like that, you know. So, and then the whole economy is sort of dependent on these infusions of federal, you know, federal gimmicks and tricks and injections of stuff just to keep it afloat, more or less afloat. Although there was an article that came out in the Washington Post, a historic kind of article, front page, recently on November 30th, here we are less than a month later, called "An Island Adrift in Economic Distress." That was the front page article with inside a full double page all on Puerto Rico on the present situation.
And what was the thrust of that?
And the thrust was the place was simply untenable. I mean, it's just you can't live there. The level of debt, you know, $70 billion, higher than any state in the United States by far. Way it leaves both the unemployment level and the level of debt, public debt, is double what it is for anywhere else in the United States. I mean, it's that bad. So, but the thing is about
In a sense, you've explained that, because if you give a tax holiday to the corporations that come into your state and you do it for 30 years, you're depriving the government of all the revenue that that kind of economic activity should and would normally provide.
Exactly.
So what you've done is you've substituted public borrowing by the state to get the revenue. So in effect, they're borrowing in the public to subsidize those corporations.
Exactly.
But it ends up that it's the debt of the government which it then has to impose on the people.
Through the usual austerity measures. And they're rampant. They go crazy.
Then
there's another economic dimension that is not often talked about and which I myself don't have my mind completely wrapped around. But the whole economy depends on bonds. And the bonds are invested in by mutual funds, U.S. mutual funds. And those bonds are particularly alluring, just like the alluring of the tax-exempt corporate situation for the industries, for the U.S. industry, and chemical industry in particular, and petrochemical industry in particular, is that these bonds are also tax-free. So the mutual funds are really attracted to getting, you know, soaking up these bonds. The thing is that a lot of the muni funds here for public workers in the States are those same mutual funds. So those bonds are getting to the status of junk. Now they're qualified. Just in the last week, they've been classified as junk. So they're no longer attractive to the mutual funds. And as a result, those mutual funds are going to have severe problems, which are then going to affect even public workers in the U.S. So these are concerns that we should have for the people of Puerto Rico. But anything that happens there, just as anything that happens here is an upshot of what happens here, it comes back up to haunt
us.
But it haunts not the government or the corporations. It haunts the working people in this country.
Right.
So there's a direct link between the colonial status, the structural reasons for these problems, and the condition of working people in the United States. So we should be concerned about what happens on that little island in the Caribbean.
There's also a historical parallel that this is what happened in every country that set up colonies, whether it's France or Belgium or England or Germany. The colonies were ripped off, and then when you couldn't rip them off, when you come to the end, it became clear that there were ways in which the inability to squeeze more out of the colonial meant that the system now had to go back and squeeze more out of its own workers. So in the end, the workers in the metropolitan country thought that maybe they were better off than those poor brothers and sisters in the colonial, but they were really caught in the same web when it finally breaks down. And this, we're going through a period where that system that was in existence for all those years is breaking down. And so you're pointing out the way, in this case, the same burden shared by the workers there and here is being played
Another
out.
Another dimension of that is that this crisis, the recession, and ever since the recession, and as it gets more and more severe, more so, has generated a huge outflow of people from Puerto Rico, another wave of emigration to the United States. This time, not so much the really poor unskilled workers that it did in the 40s and 50s with that avalanche. Now it's the kind of skilled and semi-skilled workers that are coming over because they can't get anything. There's no work for them. There's no opportunity. So they're coming in and they're filling a rank within the labor force in the United States that is in fact going to be at odds with some of the people in the United States. So there's competition, as of course the big fear that the immigrants take our jobs and all that stuff. Well, now it's not the labor, it's not like the Salvadoran day laborers. This is people that are coming in at this middle rung of the with a certain
with
amount
education
of education with certain amount of professional skills that they can't sell down there. There's no place for them. So they're flocking into Orlando, they're flocking into Austin, Texas, they're flocking to different parts, not so much New York now. Jersey's parts of Jersey. And they're feeling that kind of wrong. And now we're talking about tens of thousands have come over just in the last 2 years.
Here again, I'm just so struck by your earlier point here again, the impact on the United States. Mm-hmm. If you abuse your colony, it comes back to bite you in your own rear end. Yep. And so now we make it untenable. Educated people, which Puerto Rico desperately needs, are leaving and coming to the United States where there's already a job problem, competing for it because no other option is left for them. Right. And instead of getting angry at these folks for trying to make a life, the obvious better way to go is to understand this is a system that isn't really working. And I'm also reminded that Spain, Italy, Greece are experiencing the same exact outflow of educated young people. Mm-hmm. And think of it, Puerto Rico bore a good portion of the costs of training and educating people who, once they're trained and educated, bring their productivity to another society which didn't have to pay the costs of developing that skill.
Exactly.
There's a kind of exploitation that's going on.
It's a drain.
Juan, give me a second. We're going to take our mid-program break. Yeah. And folks, please stay with us. We'll be back in a number of seconds.
You ain't heard it while you was walking out the door. It's goodbye, baby, honey, your time has come. Turn the tables now, you the one on the bone. It's la, 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 singing la, la, la. I'm so happy you got me singing la, la, la. If I was a catfish in a river down in St. Louis, be the biggest fish.
Welcome back, friends. This is Economic Update. We're now ready to go to the second half of our program. I want to remind you, our guest is Professor Juan Flores, who I'm discussing the issue of Puerto Rico and its relationship to and its suffering under being a colony and being a colony at a time of economic crisis lasting a long time in the country for which it is a colony. I also want to remind you, as always, that if you want to pursue the topics we're dealing with here, take a look at our websites, rdwolf2fs.com and democracyatwork.info, where you can participate, communicate, sign up for the newsletter, and in other ways take advantage of the materials that build this program. Okay, Juan, let me go back and let me ask you to reflect. You've done a lifetime of thinking about Puerto Rican society and culture there and in the United States. Can you give us a sense of your view about the longer term impacts that this colonial situation and this crisis, what's going to happen to Puerto Rico and Puerto Ricans there and here in the longer run? How is this going to play out? What are the costs, in a word, for an economic system that works this way?
Well, it's always very, very vulnerable and always very prey to the vicissitudes of the U.S. economy, you know. And in this case, the United States is being appealed to by the politicians, the kind of colonial politicians down there, to do something. Help us out. Give us another injection. Do something. So the United States decides, okay, well, what we're going to do is we're going to appoint a commission and send them down there to figure out how to do this, what we can do to help. And how can we're not going to give them any more money. They make it very clear up front, no more money, just a better use of the money you were sending that your guys are getting. You got to use it better, more wisely, and so forth. The thing is, when they went down there, and these are all people from the government, U.S. government, from the different cabinet positions and so forth, the agricultural department, the environmental, this and the other, going down there, and it becomes clear that this is probably the first step in a kind of receivership. That the country is unable to deal with its own economic crisis, which of course is caused by the crisis here and the economic situation, which could easily lead to a kind of a financial control board, the way that they had for New York City.
And the way they have the Detroit
right now.
Detroit,
in fact, it's the most common comparison of Puerto Rico is with Detroit. It's also called the Greece of the Caribbean,
right,
and the Spain. Those analogies which you mentioned, but Detroit is the one that's most similar to Puerto Rico. It's in the number of public work, the whole pension fund thing is pretty close to identical. The levels of unemployment, the blight that is obvious in that part of society. The difference is that while Detroit, as I understand it, can declare bankruptcy, the Puerto Rico is treated as a state, so it's technically not allowed to declare bankruptcy. So it seems as though the next thing is default. You know, complete default, at which time the United States may well move in and pump up its colonial control over the island and make it even more of a direct, as it did with the Dominican Republic, I remember at the beginning of the 20th century, because of the debt that accumulated to such a degree, the United States just went in and took control, basically, over the situation. And so this would be then returning the colonial status of Puerto Rico to an earlier time in its history when it didn't elect its own governor, when it was appointed by the President of the United States. In the middle of the century, in the 40s and 50s, they changed the colonial status and established what's called the Free Associated Statehood, the Commonwealth status, which it still has to this day. And that meant that the people of Puerto Rico elect their own governor. Right, their own colonial governor. It's very likely, if this just intensifies, and it shows no signs of abating, there's no sign of like, wow, we're going to get out from under this, that there's going to be an increased colonial control, you know, over the island, and that it will be more under the grip of the United States, even while some of the people in Congress say, oh, we should make it a direct state of the United States. It can still be a colony, even if it's a state. Okay. They're not saying that. I mean, there's no solution to colonialism by just making it a state of the United States. It's still a colony of the United States, you know, as a country, because it is a country. You know, Puerto Rico is a nation. You know, it's a country. So anyway, that is one of the possible projections that could happen. Now, of course, then you ask, well, what about resistance? I mean, what about there must be something?
Well, even if I want to get to the resistance, but yeah, one more thing. Again, allow me to remind all of us the history here. Puerto Rico was a colony. Mm-hmm. It was decided that it's inconsistent for the United States to have colonies, mm-hmm, given that it went through a violent revolution against Britain to stop being a colony itself.
Yeah.
And that we were supposed to believe that the United States was against colonialism of the sort that the Europeans practiced. And so we gave to our colony this peculiar Commonwealth status, mm-hmm, where it elects its own government, mm, and has some of the trappings of self-determination. What you're saying now is that the economic system, capitalism, is unable to sustain this arrangement and moving back in a clear reverse, mm-hmm, historical, mm-hmm, undoing of that,
yes,
going back to being a crudely clumsily subordinated society being dictated to by the United States. The United States is going backwards historically. Yeah. Just like we're going backwards in the distribution of wealth and income, right. We're going backwards. And this story of Puerto Rico is a wonderful case study of that historical reverse direction.
Reverse direction, because capitalism can't sustain the colony. You know, it's been floating along with all these gimmicks and injections and pumping up the economy just so that it remains afloat and so that it looks good compared to the rest of Latin America. Right. Compared to Dominican Republic, compared to Cuba, which are the Haiti. Immediate comparisons. Haiti. So, wow, you have this, you know, this showcase of democracy, and it was the beacon
all
of
that. And of all hope. Of that is now
but
out
was,
the window.
It was all out the window because it was all pumped up on gimmicks. It wasn't because of a robust economy by the people, by the society itself. It was all just depending upon these little ploys that came along as time went on.
And now, the tax holiday
and
for those
and then
companies.
It created this veil of sovereignty. You know, of like, oh, they're managing their own affairs while they're being told at the same time the Puerto Ricans are really incapable of governing their own affairs. And that was always the kind of the under. So it's a deeply hypocritical relationship. It always has been. And in the 30s, where you have the precedent to this, there was the crisis, okay? At that time, in 1934, the country went wild with strikes, huge strikes all across the sugar plantations that ruled the economy of Puerto Rico, the Nationalist Party for anti-imperialist party, and then the Socialist and Communist parties formed then. The Communist Party was established in 1934 in Puerto Rico, and it was on the basis of the huge, massive strikes of the sugar workers throughout the country. The economy was paralyzed, not because of the economic situation that caused by the U.S., but because the people of the society were revolting against that relationship. So then what happened was there was an accommodation. Let's industrialize. So because the agricultural economy was proving unsustainable and too labor intensive. So you're going to have this huge excess of workers when you industrialize. What are you going to do with them? Sterilize the women and emigrate them to the United States. That's why by the end of the 40s, you had this huge avalanche of people coming over here, you know, by the thousands every day.
There was no work there.
Because there was no work there. So they planned, and this was all coordinated with the corporations here and the government, the puppet government in Puerto Rico, plan how to outmove these people, bring them up to the New York where they're all going to find employment. Meanwhile, the base economic base of New York City was falling out from under it. So they come to a situation where, what is the outcome? Welfare. The outcome is massive unemployment, ghettoization of the community, and so forth. And that's what you have to this day in the South Bronx, El Barrio, poverty-stricken neighborhoods, where still, even though there has been some gain by some Puerto Ricans, and they always broadcast the gains and how people have two-car garages and they live in Florida and all this stuff, the massive, overwhelming majority of Puerto Rican people are living in dire straits, seriously dire straits.
In the time we have remaining, is there any kind of renewal of a resistance movement? You mentioned the one in the 30s.
Right.
Here we have
big
another
time.
Crisis
yeah.
threatening dire future for Puerto Rico.
Right.
Whether on the island or in New York or elsewhere in the United States, is there some sign of a developing criticism and a movement to oppose this kind of development and to come up with alternatives? In the remaining minutes we have, tell us a little bit about what there is.
Yeah, there's definitely signs of in many different directions, many angles. Of course, there have been decades of smashing the labor unions, you know, so that as you described before in your update, the organized labor is in serious trouble, you know, and very weakened by these developments. However, you have several strong elements within the labor movement that are still very militant and very opposed to these things. And so immediately after, for example, during the government shutdown, with the freezing of the pension funds and the
closing back in 2006,
and then every step along the way, there have been spontaneous protests, and some of them actually very quiet, organized by various groups, including labor, but also even some of the church, you know, is involved. But also you have big environmental movements in Puerto Rico, which always coalesce with these movements. You have the formation of new parties because it's been dominated by two, and then the third, the Independence Party, gets a very tiny fraction of the vote and doesn't really have a program for the working class on the island. So it's been a kind of independence movement without a class kind of analysis to it. So as a result, some more working class oriented and community oriented organizations have formed and are becoming more activated over time. Then in the university, which you mentioned, the university's in dire shambles, I mean, in terms of administration and budget and so forth, there's been massive strikes of students. You know, just a couple of years ago, the whole thing was shut down. All the various campuses of the University of Puerto Rico were shut down, which has then caused, serious austerity measures at the university, so that the professors have been, deprived of their vacation times, their tenure things are much more questionable, as you were saying. Adjunct replacement and substitution by part-time people is all over the, all very widespread. Travel money for research support gone. Teaching responsibilities increased hugely, double what they used to be. So it's a very difficult situation. But Puerto Ricans are used to struggle. They have a long history of struggling against domination. So things do crop up and movements do emerge in spite of the very difficult situation that there is. There's a legacy of this, and when you know the people down there and you talk to them, they're determined, to fight back. They're just going to take it lying down.
I know it's pure speculation, but give us an idea of what you think is the most potentially hopeful movement to change all of the direction.
Well, the movements that have been most vocal and involved the most people have been kind of deflections from the economic. You had Vieques, which is economic, but they were complaining about situations on that little island that are just as serious on the big islands, but they were more symbolically laden. Yeah. Then you have a big movement to free one of the last of the political prisoners, Oscar Lopez, right now, as we speak. Big marches and demonstrations to free the political prisoner. They've got a bunch of the other ones freed over time. They've gotten clemency. They're back out in the world and so forth and so on. So those are all good. You don't want to poo-poo them. And they do, in fact, agglutinate. All the population gets in behind it. So you have this sense of national pride and national conviction. But it's not really directed at the day-to-day problems that people live in Puerto Rico. People living on plastic, on credit cards, and debt, incredible, being swallowed by debts. In the society, so they're kind of deflections from the crucial political issues and economic issues of the society. I think when that energy gets channeled over and they address it head on, not so much by saying we got to be independent, because that has also drawn a lot of energy away from dealing with the day-to-day issues, the economic issues that are facing people in their everyday working lives. When that energy is pushed in that direction, and that is the basis for a movement for independence, I think that there's a chance that there could be dramatic changes in the status of Puerto Rico.
Juan, it's been wonderful.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Nice to have.
Can
nice
you
to
come
be here.
Back some point?
Absolutely.
And
I
give
love
us
to,
an
Rick.
Update.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for your updates. I really appreciate them.
Okay. In the remaining time we have, I'm going to respond to some of your questions, as we often do. I really found Juan Flores's discussion historically and politically exciting to understand. It's the first step in overcoming a problem like that, is to understand it and to see it. And it's a comment, it's a way of looking at our economic system from the standpoint of a particular place, Puerto Rico and Puerto Ricans, that helps get the picture right and avoid the glitz and hype that normally covers this topic. Okay, first of the questions that I want to address. The Bitcoin. Many of you have written to me about the Bitcoin movement. So let me explain briefly what that is and where it's going. Bitcoins are a kind of virtual currency. They're produced by a computer program, and a group of linked computers have developed this kind of money. It's not a money issued by any government, and therefore it's not a money under the control of the government. So on one level, this is an attempt by private people using the internet and computers to set up a free, open, unregulated money substitute. And as such, it's part of many movements to get around government controls and around corporation monopolies to create a freer space for economic transactions. Given that governments, usually in cahoots with banks, big banks, control currencies around the world, it's not at all surprising that governments and banks have been very hostile and leery about this Bitcoin movement. But the money keeps circulating. It's been going on now for several years, got a real boost since 2009. It is now traded around the world. You can buy and sell Bitcoins, and you can increasingly use Bitcoins as a substitute for money. For example, WordPress.com, a very important computer company, accepts payment in bitcoins. So does the dating website OkCupid, and there are others. So that it's now possible to enter the world of Bitcoin, get some Bitcoins, buy them, and use them to make payments. And in the process, get around government regulations, get around the need for the person you're paying with Bitcoins to give any share of it to MasterCard or Visa or anybody else who dips their fingers in the normal money movements. So it is a phenomena, but I must say there are two things to keep in mind. One, because it isn't controlled by any government or the banks, it oscillates wildly. It moves up and down sometimes as much as 40 or 50% in a matter of days as to what it's worth. So you could buy a Bitcoin and see it lose an enormous amount of money. Therefore, it's a highly speculative thing to go into. And finally, governments are hostile to it. The Chinese government in this last week has basically forbidden all kinds of uses for this Bitcoin activity. Those who defend it think that it'll get through these hard times and that we're going to have a growing, let's call it independent, non-governmental money alongside the money that we're used to. And that will change many things. So that's where this Bitcoin discussion now stands. Second question that you are interested in has to do with Detroit, again, as it came up in our discussion with Professor Flores. Detroit saw a decision by a bankruptcy court that basically said that the city, in dealing with its bankruptcy, could not only refuse to pay back all it owes to creditors, but could consider pensioners, people who had retired from a lifetime of working for the city of Detroit, it could also cut their pensions. In other words, it looked upon the pension as a kind of debt that the city had. And many of you asked me, isn't that illegal or unconstitutional? First, because the Michigan Constitution specifically forbids doing that. And number two, because the U.S. Constitution forbids the government from passing laws that infringe on freely arrived at contracts. We're supposed to be a society that makes the contract sacrosanct. If two people sign a contract voluntarily, then it's binding. I think here there's a practical and a legal question to be answered in terms of the economic effects. First, the practical question. Every law in economics, and I believe this is true outside of economics, but this is a program about economics. So every law in economics has exceptions, and the reason it has exceptions is sooner or later, every law in economics that covers economics clashes with another law. So let me give you some examples. Can a man and another man, or a man and a woman, or a woman and a woman, can they make a contract in which one of them provides prostitution services to the other? The answer is sure, you can make such a contract. But the government passes laws that invalidates that contract. So here's an example where two different concerns, the sanctity of contracts on the one hand and the opposition to prostitution on the other, clash. And then you have a situation where an exception is made. The government observes the sanctity of contracts, except when they cover prostitution. Another example is the law of eminent domain. The law of eminent domain says a city can, if it needs it for the benefit of the whole community, overrule the private contracts of individuals. So, for example, you own a piece of land in a town, and you'd make a contract to sell it to John. But the city comes in and says, no, we want to buy it instead of John. They can use the power of eminent domain to invalidate your contract with John and force you to sell the land to the city. So there are examples that are in our system, and even though they, on some technical level, contradict a state or even the federal constitution, there's plenty of precedent to try to handle what is inevitably the case, which is there are all kinds of contradictions you didn't foresee when you passed the law, but that confront you in the reality of life. And I think what you're seeing is the power of politics and the power of the capitalist system in Detroit. This is a city that was destroyed by the decision of major capitalist automobile companies to make more money by moving production away. They were free in our system to do that. They're free enterprises. Our system also enables them not only to move freely where they can make more money, but to be required to pay none of the costs of the immense damage to countless people that their free enterprise decision resulted in. They're free to go, and they're free to avoid paying for the disasters that their decision makes. Now, you can call that into question, but that's what the free enterprise system enabled them to do. So now you're left with a disaster. How are you going to handle that disaster? You could, of course, go and tax those wealthy people in and around Detroit, those corporations still busy there, in order to tax those who are most able to pay. But then you're afraid that as free enterprises, they'll leave to avoid the tax. You're caught. And what that means is you're stuck in a system that doesn't give you any wiggle room to solve your problems. So what is it that Detroit is going to do? The reaction to the decision of free enterprises to leave, Ford, General Motors, Chrysler, and so on, is now going to be supplemented by a decision not to tax the remaining corporations and wealthy for fear that they'll do the same thing. So what are you going to end up doing? You're not going to pay a pension to a retired teacher or police officer or firefighter. And that, of course, is going to have horrible consequences for them, for the stores that depend on them, and so on. So this is a system that is forced to be dysfunctional, to let a city be destroyed, to be unable to solve the problem, except by doing self-destructive cruelty to the people least able to defend themselves. That's what that bankruptcy decision in Detroit means. And that's why it's not just a critique of the law. It's not even just a critique of that bankruptcy judge. It's a critique of a system that keeps making folks, whether they're businesses or workers or unions or judges, make decisions that are socially destructive because they have no other way to go. When that happens, it doesn't pay to get angry at the law or the judge. The problem is a system that leaves us no other choices than these, and these are unacceptable. Thank you again for your time. We've come to the end of the program. This is Richard Wolff. The program is Economic Update. Please remember our websites and to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. And I hope to talk to you again next week.
But after a while, gonna be my time, babe. Thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.